The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're off and running here already, though, the mid part of the week, as we work our way through these spring festivals, the days of unleavened bread. I mentioned yesterday, as part of our trip to Virginia and North Carolina, that we saw this fantastic museum in Yorktown, and some have mentioned to me here since I returned that they visited the Waterloo Museum, just south of, I know it's in Belgium, so I think it's just south of Brussels. In any event, they said the same thing, just a wonderful visit. And of course, they went in, the students and the McDonald's, they went into that visit well-equipped historically, as we've just finished the Andrew Roberts biography on Napoleon. So, but they communicate, too, that that museum is well worth the visit. So I'll have to get over to that one when I'm on the continent next time around. On today's show, we're going to be getting into following up on yesterday's Bible study. We're going to continue with our study of the plagues of Exodus. So some meat in due season. You can stay tuned for that. That'll be coming up in the second segment. Well, as part of our travels, just some of the reading that we were trying to do, me and my wife, my son, especially me and my wife, though, with the latest issue of the Trumpet magazine, in the middle part of the issue. This is actually the feature of the Trumpet, the most recent issue. I think it's the May-June issue. It's Joel Hilliker's article, Climate, Gender, and the Fight Over Truth. If you haven't yet gotten around to that article, I would encourage you to read it. Just an excellent piece to really help us to stay grounded in what is true and right, the absolute truth. In this article, Mr. Hilliker sets it up by talking about climate change, and then after that, the transgender movement. And he points out how that on the one hand, you have all of these climate change advocates saying that the world's going to end and we need to have a bigger, more powerful government to take control over everything, pretty much. And that this is all because of science. All the scientists agree, they keep saying. Barack Obama tweeted out in 2013 that 97% of scientists agree that, that climate change is man-made. That it's man's fault. And you have, like in the case of this one Republican that Joel Hilliker quotes in his article, you have a lot of Republicans that, or people that that don't believe that it's man-made. They're just caving into the pressure. It's just nonstop. It's so intense. One Republican from Illinois, he said that, well, it's just not worth the fight anymore. It's just not worth the fight. Just go ahead and let them have it. Let them have their way. And, well, we'll draw the line with respect to the economy. If their proposals, if their programs, if they hurt the economy, then we'll push back. But never mind if it's true or false. Never mind if it's right or wrong. It's just not worth the fight. You see that a lot today. People that just give in, even if they don't believe it's the truth. They just give in. They cave in to the pressure. It's not worth fighting for, the truth. Well, you have this example on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you have the transgender movement, which tells you to forget about science. Science is the problem. As Mr. Hilliker brings out in his article, if you really want to fall back on science, it proves without question. This is not 97%. This is 100%. It proves that there are biological differences between men and women. And that, as Mr. Hilliker brings out, those biological differences enable men to run faster, to lift more weight. They have more endurance. That's according to study after study after study. But never mind that. If someone comes along and says, I'm no longer a man, I'm a woman. And this is happening over and again, and you're seeing more and more stories, just like he brings out in his article, of men who are competing now against women because they say they're women. And surprise, surprise, they end up winning the track meet or the weightlifting competition. Is this contradictory? The one crying out, science! It's all about science. And the other side saying, forget about science. Mr. Hilliker writes, in one sense, the climate change dogma and the transgender dogma seem contradictory. One is wrapping itself in the cloak of science, and the other isn't even trying. But in fact, these are two aspects of the same story. They're two aspects of the same story. He said the truth is, this is not the age of rationality. This is the age of astonishing irrationality. Society today is openly assaulting the truth. That's the victim here. Truth. Isaiah 59, it's being cast to the ground. Truth is being buried. It's two sides of the same coin, this is. This is not the age of rationality. It's the age of astonishing irrationality. He goes in there, by the way, regarding that tweet from Barack Obama in 2013. Mr. Hilliker points out how that they're manipulating the studies. It's really less than a third, or about a third, of scientists who think that it's man-made. The majority, they're either against it or they're not sure. So why not at least report the honest truth with respect to the studies? Well, they can't do that. They've got to play around with the facts and create the narrative. And then pressure people, intimidate people into going along, just like that Republican congressman. Well, it's just not worth fighting anymore. Here in the UK over the past week, I guess it was over the Easter weekend in particular, you had quite a few disruptive protests in London. People protesting for the government to do something about climate change. These protesters, at least this most recent movement here in the UK, they call themselves the Extinction Rebellion. And if you look at The Guardian today, the support for this so-called Extinction Rebellion, people that are saying humanity is going to cease to exist within the next generation. Not because of world war. Not because of madmen with biological and nuclear weapons. No, it's going to cease to exist, humanity, because of carbon emissions. Well, the support for this group, it's quadrupled in the past 9 days. It's a relatively small group, but it just gets so much notoriety and publicity. And for a time, they were being so disruptive to travelers, bike riders, anything in London, and the police wouldn't do anything. And now there's a growing wave of support. And yet when you listen to their reasoning, like Mr. Hilliker brings out in his article, this is not truth-based reasoning. This is the age of astonishing irrationality. Listen to what one protester had to say on Sky News, clip one.
You want us to be carbon zero by 2025. In your view, what does that mean?
It means rapidly decarbonizing the society. If we understand the severity of the issue, we would
give us some examples.
We would rapidly
What happens to air travel? What happens to foreign holidays?
We would only use air travel in emergencies.
We can create
mass city farms, solar panels, these things that can be done but are not being done because people don't understand.
Okay, so no holidays, no foreign travel, no foreign business.
The issue is about life and death.
No, I'm just asking you, that's what you're saying.
I understand, and I'm thinking about my brother. I'm thinking about the fact that me and him might not be able to have food in the future because of we're facing starvation.
So this is a disciple of Ocasio-Cortez. We've got to put a ban on air travel. It's just that serious. And you listen to that and think, well, it's crazy. And yet, look at the attention they get this weekend or this past weekend. Look at how disruptive they are. There was a study finds a survey that Richard showed me just today. 1 in 5 millennials think climate change will cause the extinction of humanity during their lifetime. 1 in 5. They believe it. They are believers. They are disciples. And they have lots of leaders like Barack Obama. Like pretty much any Democratic candidate that are there to tell them they're right. It says here, a new survey shows that 3/4 of adults agree that climate change will cause the extinction of humanity. In fact, nearly half of the 2,000 Americans over 18 surveyed feel climate change will doom the planet within the next 200 years. Shockingly, many young adults think 200 years is a generous number. The survey finds that 1 in 5 millennials actually believes that climate change will bring about the end of the world during their lifetime. This is what they're being told in the Green New Deal. This is what congressmen and women are saying. Presidential candidates. It says, while nearly all respondents, 96%, admit they're worried about climate change to some degree, 1 in 4 say it's their biggest fear, with millennials twice as likely to feel that way. A fifth of millennials say they won't even have children because they fear the condition of the planet for future generations. So they're already taking action in that way. In other ways, of course, they're completely hypocritical, like the one you just heard. He flies all over the world. He's on the news, Sky News, telling people that the government ought to ban air travel. They want all these rules forced upon the public by the government. And until that happens, they continue on with their lifestyles of using air travel and so on and so forth. There was the story recently with Bernie Sanders. It's a little further on in my notes here. He made all that money because he wrote a book. He's a millionaire. He's in the top 1%. He's part of the problem if you listen to what the Democrats are saying. Making all of this money. And like this one commentator says, he's a capitalist if ever there was one. And yet he's out there talking about the virtues of socialism. He considers himself a socialist, but he's a socialist in word only. This article says here, Senator Sanders belatedly released his tax returns this week. The New York Times reported the returns show that Mr. Sanders' earnings shot up after his first presidential bid when he built up a vast national following. He and his wife reported income that topped $1 million in 2016 and 17, lifted by proceeds from his books. And then it goes and gives some of the numbers, the money that he's pulling in. Senator Sanders said, it talks about this town hall, I guess it was on Fox or something else a week or two back. And he said, I wrote a best-selling book. If you write a best-selling book, you can be a millionaire too. And then this columnist says, but his incarnation as John Galt didn't last. In a Fox News town hall, Bret Baier asked him, when you wrote the book and you made the money, isn't that the definition of capitalism and the American dream? And after an uncomfortable pause, the senator answered, no, no. But he's wrong. Having an idea, acting on it, and making a pile of money is the very definition of a successful entrepreneurship. He's a capitalist, in other words. And, well, you should read the rest of the article. He was asked again, or at least one of his representatives, well, you know, he's paying something like 25, 20, 26% in taxes, and he's out there advocating 70% for the top 1%. Why doesn't he pay 70%? Well, that's just not the way things are done. So says the rep. Well, you can do it. And some people do actually do it. But not these hypocrites that are out there saying raise the taxes on everyone else, even as they try to keep the lower bracket for themselves, even as they keep using air travel to vacation around the world, even. We're living in the age of astonishing irrationality. It's just astonishing. And then the hypocrisy that knows no bounds. Some of these protesters, they know that the only way that they're going to get their message out there is to rise up and to cause violence, or to cause the cities or the transportation for the people of London to just shut down. Another protester, again, this is one from one of the news shows here in the UK, had this to say, clip two.
The reason why we do this is because it actually causes economic pause. So the only way we've realised the government will listen to us is if we actually start to ruin the economy. It's really sad that money talks so loudly that that's the only way we'll actually be listened to. So that's why we've taken these disruptive actions.
Okay, but how does blocking a cycle path or climbing on top of an electric train help do that?
For example, the blockades that we did, I think it was the Evening Standard that basically said that we caused £12 million loss in a couple days to the West End. So it's through that we've actually gotten our voices heard, and it's through that we've basically told people, you can come, you can hear about it, you can listen to it.
And she's right, because like this other article from The Guardian says, the support for this is Extinction Rebellion, it's soaring. You can cause $12 million in damage. You can try to ruin the economy and win favor from others who believe in man-made climate change. Imagine that. The thinking here. Well, we won't be heard. Our message won't go out unless we start to ruin the economy. It's sad that we have to do that, but we have to do it. It's a necessary evil. We've got to be disruptive. We've got to cause damage. We've got to erect a blockade. That's the thinking. And the police, at least for the better part of it, they just stood by and smiled. Melanie Phillips, she had a piece at the Times earlier this week where she said that that for the best part of a week, the Metropolitan Police has hung back while Extinction Rebellion protesters invaded parts of central London to cause maximum disruption. As irration mounted, excuses were trotted out about too few police resources and too many protesters. This was shown to be nonsense when, after public exasperation turned into political anger, the police finally removed the protesters and made more than 1,000 arrests. In other words, their earlier failure to act was caused by an absence of, or rather not by an absence of resources, but by an absence of will. They just wouldn't do anything. And then they made the excuses. Well, we can't. We've got too much going on. There's too many protesters. And then finally, the public just outraged. They can't get from point A to point B. And so the police finally give in and do something. And there's other protests that she writes about in her column as well. People out at Hyde Park smoking cannabis, saying that it ought to be legalized. She writes, on Saturday, the Met proceeded to do diddly squat about cannabis smokers on open display in Hyde Park, where an estimated crowd of more than 5,000 gathered to campaign for legalization. Despite the police signs proclaiming, anyone found in possession of drugs faces arrest and prosecution, there were no arrests. Here again, there was no will to enforce the law. Melanie Phillips says one officer told a journalist he was concerned for demonstrators' health, not from cannabis, but from the sun. Think of it. There are a lot of pasty white people out here today, he said. This is a spokesman for the police. They're going to get sunburnt. They get stoned and they'll forget about the sun, and before they know it, they could get sunstroke. This is what the police this is what they're worried about. Melanie Phillips says, should we laugh or cry? A police officer saying that, well, because they're smoking cannabis, which is illegal, they might get sunstroke. So we're trying to help them understand the dangers here. She says this is what safeguarding society's boundaries looks like when those boundaries have themselves become obscured by a cultural fog. Listen to how she concludes here, because it's right in step with what Mr. Hilliker covers in the latest Trumpet. Go and read that, as I say. The feature article, Climate, Gender, and the Fight over Truth. Melanie Phillips says the police are merely reflecting a consensus promulgated by the intellectual, political, and cultural establishment. Here again, we're living in the age of astonishing irrationality. The consensus, she says, comprises, among other things, unquestioning faith in the benefits of drug liberalization, the looming catastrophe of man-made global warming, as well as identity politics and the grievance culture. It repudiates reason and evidence, prioritizes feelings over facts, and roots itself in the breakdown of social and moral norms. And she says it is also enforced through coercion. It's forced upon us. It's will worship. This is the point Mr. Hilliker makes at the end of his piece, going through Colossians 2, which we've gone through before on this program. It's will worship. There's no submission to the will of God. That's flat out rejected. God is not, he's not even factored into the equation. And neither are truth and facts. And so what is left? Will worship. Worshiping the human will. Imposing your will on someone else, even if they're equipped with the truth. Like in the case of that Republican that Mr. Hilliker quoted, well, it's just not worth fighting for. So we'll just try to draw the line with respect to the economy. That's the way many are reasoning. There's no will to fight for the truth. There's a lot of will worship. My father gave a program a couple of years ago. This was in response to quite a few weather disasters. But he mentions in this program just how deadly this climate change deception really and truly is. Here's a snippet from that show, clip 3.
Do those who talk about climate change diligently seek God? Well, I think it's usually what I've seen anyhow is the reverse of that. They just leave God totally out of the picture, and God won't be left out. He will not be. I don't care what a trillion men say, he won't be left out.
That's from his program in late 2017. Mr. Hilliker also draws attention to an article that my father gave or wrote. It's that one where he talked about Melanie Phillips, actually, and some of the things that she's written about the breakdown of the family. You can go back and look at our featured story in the July 2017 Trumpet. That's the one that talks about the family breakdown. Look for my father's personal in that issue. But here he is on the Key of David saying that God is He's left out of the picture. And God's not going to be left out. You think about so many of the prophecies that we talk about on this program. We are, Jesus said so, we're facing human extinction. If God didn't intervene, this is Matthew 24. If God did not intervene, we would wipe ourselves out. And yet, here you see this counterfeit, this great counterfeit, and it's astonishing how many people believe that we're facing human extinction because of carbon emissions, because of air travel, because of cows and such. If only they knew. You can see blindness has set in. The devil is certainly behind it. It's a deadly deception, like my father brought out. One more clip from that Key of David show, clip 4.
But look, if you just make that blanket statement about climate change, about it just causing all of these violent storms, you're rejecting everything God says about that subject. You're just rejecting it. I don't think those people that say that would normally always say that they're anti-God or not religious or whatever. But what they're saying is in direct conflict with what God says. And who do you think is going to prevail in that issue? We need to think about that.
That's from my father's show back in late 2017. They're rejecting everything God says about weather-related disasters. They reject everything that God says about great tribulation. Great tribulation. And they substitute in its place all these prophecies, their own religion, and it's being forced upon people against their will. Mr. Hilliker talks about the pressure, peer pressure, ideology, even some of the scientists, certainly many of the academics, a lot of the politicians, they give in to the pressure. Will worship. Well, if you read all the way through to the end of Joel Hilliker's piece, a very inspiring conclusion there about being set free from deception by the truth of God. That's a Days of Unleavened Bread theme as well. Released from captivity, God's truth. It's the only way. There's a verse in Isaiah 1 that talks about reasoning together with God. That's what true education boils down to. Reasoning together with God, because as Isaiah also brings out later in his book, our thoughts are not God's thoughts. And so we have to consult with Him. We have to speak to Him. We have to study His Word. We have to reason together with God. That's in Isaiah 1, verse 18. Verse 19 says, "If you be willing and obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you shall be devoured with the sword, for the mouth of the Eternal has spoken it." In other words, if you reason together with God, then He'll give you the very best. He'll give you the best of everything. He'll bless you for your obedience. We have a choice in this. We have to choose God's way. We have to go after God's truth. We have to hunger for righteousness. We have to let His mind in. Well, go back, as I say, read that article from the most recent trumpet, Truth, or rather the subject, the title being Climate, Gender, and the Fight Over Truth. And then I don't have the exact title from my father's personal. That's back in the summer of 2017. But again, you find that referred to in that article by Joel Hilliker. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
Oh, my God.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Throughout the Bible, God uses his material creation as a vital instrument through which he communicates with mankind.
The scene is nothing short of apocalyptic.
We have nothing left.
The so-called natural disasters we see increasing are, in fact, a tool that the creator of the natural world has reserved for himself to use in order to speak with us.
We have been praying for quite a while now for the eye to pass over so we can get some kind of a break.
Severe natural phenomena are impossible to ignore. Yet for most people, even as our planet is coming apart, the message is still not resonating.
Tonight, along the Texas Gulf Coast, utter devastation. In the town of Rockport, entire blocks are decimated.
The question is, are you prepared to listen?
You know, this is of biblical proportions, Fred. Take a look around me.
Our town is destroyed, and it hurts.
Jesus Christ listed nature-related disasters as being a sign of his imminent return. Request the free booklet, Why Natural Disasters, so that you can discern the signs of the times. To order our free booklet, email your request to td@kpcg.fm. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
You can read about the 10 plagues of Egypt in Exodus 7 through Exodus 12. We introduced this subject on yesterday's program, the tail end of the show. You can listen to that at the trumpet.com website if you'd like to go back and begin the study with the second half of yesterday's show. And for today, I won't go through at least all of the scriptures that describe these 10 plagues. Again, we'll just try to see the bigger picture here and focus in on that 10th and final plague in Exodus 12. But before that, look at Exodus 8. And in verse 1, it says, "And the Eternal spoke unto Moses, Go unto Pharaoh and say to him, Thus says the Eternal, Let my people go, that they may serve me." We touched on this point yesterday. That they might be able to serve their God. And so then God started to just pound the Egyptians with these plagues. And the Pharaoh, he kept hardening his heart. But this was something that was going on for the better part of a year. You can look into some of the commentaries and see that those first 9 plagues, they probably took about that long. It's easy to associate all of these plagues with just the days in between the days of unleavened bread. But what led up to these days, of course, was that 10th and final plague, which we'll look at here in just a second. But that was the culmination of a year of curses, of a year of plagues, the Nile turning into blood. And then the plagues of frogs and flies and bugs and lice. And then their cattle dying of a mysterious disease. And then all of the painful boils. And the storms, the hailstones, the locusts, the darkness, the thick darkness. And in all of this, God was executing judgment on Egypt. Judgment against their false gods. He sentenced them. He cursed them because of their paganism. Because of their cruel treatment of the Israelites. He humbled them. He humbled Pharaoh. One commentary says that God was upset with Egypt because of how severely they were punishing the Israelites. So all of that's part of this story, but we have to, again, keep in mind the big picture here, as I touched on yesterday, in that God was orchestrating all of these incredible events because of what they pointed to in his plan of salvation. He orchestrated all of this, all of the symbols and the types. And those history lessons, they're there for our learning. 1 Corinthians 10 says, It's so that we might learn from this history. It's so that we might understand the symbolism. Exodus chapter 10, in verse 7, it says, "And Pharaoh's servants said to him, 'How long shall this man be a snare unto us? Let the men go, that they may serve the Eternal their God. Know you not yet that Egypt is destroyed?'" These are Pharaoh's servants that had had enough of being pounded by God for a year in the Tale of Two Prophets. This is the old booklet produced by the Worldwide Church of God. It says, over a period of about a year, God, through Moses and Aaron, punished that great nation, Egypt, with such devastating miracles that it looked worse than Germany after World War II. In fact, it ceased to function as a nation for more than a generation. This was catastrophic, the destruction. And yet God had to continue on all the way through to the last plague, the tenth and final plague, the final miracle that would then set the Israelites free from bondage. Chapter 11, Exodus 11, he talks about, Moses did, about God giving the people of Israel favor in the sight of the Egyptians, spoiling the Egyptians. And then we come to Exodus 12. This instruction here about the Passover and the night to be much observed, the days of unleavened bread. You don't hear much about this in the world today. You don't even hear about the history. You certainly don't hear about the meaning. What it all typed. Verse 1, "And the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, 'This month shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you.'" They had been in captivity and slavery for centuries, and they lost track of time. And so God had to straighten that out to begin with. And here they were in the beginning month, the spring month, when everything is new and budding. That's the way God starts his year. Certainly not in the dead of winter. Verse 3, it says, "Speak you unto all the congregation of Israel, saying, in the tenth day of this month, they shall take of them every man a lamb according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for an house." So this is the first time, verse 3 here, the first time where you see the word congregation in the Bible, meaning assembly, or really it's a very similar word to the Greek word in the New Testament, ekklesia, which means called out ones. It refers to God's church in the New Testament as the called out ones. And here you see the called out nation. All of this was to be a type of God's church, spiritual Israel. And look at this lamb sacrifice. What could this be about? The Israelites taking this little lamb, each household doing this, taking a little lamb without blemish. And of course, they took it on the 10th day of the first month. And then they were supposed to analyze and scrutinize this lamb for 4 days. And that's because it had to be without spot or blemish. It represented Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God. It says in 1 Peter 1 that he was a lamb without spot or blemish. It refers to his precious blood. Verse 6. Here in Exodus 12, it says, "And you shall keep it up until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it in the evening or between sunset and dark." That's right at the start of the 14th day of the first month. Right at the start of the day. Not at the start of the 15th, like the Jews keep it. But they were to sacrifice the lamb after sunset, just after sunset on the 14th, and then eat the flesh of that lamb that night. And they were not to leave their homes during the night of the 14th. Verse 12, it says, "For I will pass through the land of Egypt this night, and will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. I am the Eternal. So this was the final plague. And God wants to make, he wants us to make this intensely personal. Each of us. The death angel came through the land that night and killed all the firstborn of the men of Egypt. Well, the beasts of the field as well. This was a type of the death penalty that sin brings upon us. And you can see how that the Israelites were protected or spared or passed over. Verse 13 says, "And the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And the plague shall not be upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt." So God gave them all of this detailed instruction. It was a test. God was testing Israel to see if they would listen to God, to see if they would obey God, to see if they would follow his instructions. And they had to do it precisely, with exactness. Our deliverance, spiritually speaking, it's not possible without this perfect lamb sacrifice and without our obedience to these instructions. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 7, it says, "Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us." He's the lamb slain from the foundation of the world, Revelation 13, 8. And that blood, the blood from that lamb is what protects us from death. So long as we claim that sacrifice and then go on out of Egypt, following God's lead, following that pillar cloud. Verse 29, it says, this is in Exodus 12, "And it came to pass that at midnight, the Eternal smote all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on his throne unto the firstborn of the captive that was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the cattle." This was in the middle of the night on the 14th. So much death. Verse 30 says, "And Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all of his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead." It was a bloody night, to say the least, a gruesome night. Just imagine hearing the wails of the Egyptians. All of these Israelite families just surrounded by death. And yet knowing that the lamb's blood had spared them, had spared their children, had spared their firstborn. And this was all meant to point us to the Messiah. That precious blood that saves us from sure death. Verse 31, it says, "And he called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, Rise up and get you forth from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go and serve the Eternal as you have said." So finally here, Pharaoh calls for Moses and Aaron, and he tells them to leave. He says, "You can go. Go ahead. Leave. Get out of here. Serve your God." But look at what it took to bring him through to this point. 1 year of just being pounded with curses, and his own assistants coming forward and saying, "Look, Pharaoh, let these people go." But he wouldn't do it. God kept hardening his heart. And through it all, well, he's just demonstrating here how hard he fights for us. Pharaoh, like I covered yesterday, he's a type of Satan. And his army, it's a type of Satan's demon army. But you have Moses as a type of Jesus Christ. And you see that when God acts miraculously, Satan has to let us go. He doesn't want to, but he has to release us. In the Pagan Holidays, or God's Holy Days witch booklet, my father, Mr. Armstrong, rather, he says, while Israel was in Egypt, They were Pharaoh's slaves, helpless and powerless under his taskmasters. It says, just as the sinner is in the power of the devil, it says. But when Israel took the blood of the lamb, then God acted. And as a result, Pharaoh released Israel. It says, when we accept Christ's blood, God acts, and the devil must release us. Yes, indeed, God's more powerful than the devil. We have to go to God. We accept that sacrifice and then begin to walk by faith, knowing that God will save us, knowing that God will prevail. In Haley's Bible Handbook, it says nearly a year had passed. At last, the crisis was at hand. The blow fell. Pharaoh yielded, and Israel departed. It says, except for the 10 plagues, Israel would never have been delivered, and there would have been no Hebrew nation. It's God, you see, who gets the credit. You see how important this history is for us. We need it. We need to meditate on it. We need to be inspired by it. We need to know that God is there fighting for us. God is there to lead us to freedom, the ultimate freedom. Freedom in the truth. Freedom within God's laws, within his family government. Verse 33, and the Egyptians were urgent upon the people that they might send them out of the land in haste. For they said, we be all dead men. So now they wanted to get rid of these slaves. The taskmasters are afraid of the slaves. The tables completely turned because of God's intervention. Verse 35, and the children of Israel did according to the word of Moses, and they borrowed of the Egyptians jewels of silver, jewels of gold, and raiment. And the Eternal gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they lent unto them such things as they required, and they spoiled the Egyptians. All of this was in fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham that they'd leave their captivity wealthy. Here, God, he not only releases them, he gives them favor with the Egyptians, their captors. What an awesome display of power. God's mighty hand, God's miraculous intervention, God making it all possible, and then the Israelites responding to God, obeying their God. Can we get the lessons here? When you consider the process of coming out of this world and sin and darkness and all that God and the sacrifice of Christ make possible, we have to follow their lead. We have to flee from Egypt. We have to come out of this world. Think of that final prayer, that Passover prayer from Jesus Christ in John 17. He prayed for us. God, protect them from the evil one. Protect them from Satan's army. Help for them to come out of this world. They can't be removed physically and taken off into a cave somewhere, but they're in this world, but protect them from the evil of the world. Of course, we have a job to do while in this world. We have a message to proclaim. But as for the world and its ways of sin, that's what we leave behind when coming into the church. Verse 37, and the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 on foot that were men beside children. So 2 or 3 million people in a line that went on, no doubt, for 5 or 6 miles. Men, women, children, all of their livestock. Verse 40, it says, now the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years, and it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day it came to pass, that all the hosts of the Eternal went out from the land of Egypt. It's a night to be much observed unto the Eternal for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. It's a night for celebration. It's a night to be much observed. That's what God wills. That's what God wants. And so most in the world ignore it. They know nothing about it. They don't observe it. They don't celebrate. They're just very much in the world. Even when you look at the world of traditional Christianity, they don't understand this truth, this history, what it means. They assume that a dead Christ is just hanging on the cross and that completes God's plan. That's not the end. That's the beginning. That's the first festival. That Passover sacrifice, that Passover lamb, that's just number one of seven annual festivals. And taken together, it gives us a complete picture of what God's working out here below. In the Good News from 1979, Herbert Armstrong said, to observe Passover alone and then fail to observe the 7 days of unleavened bread means, in the symbolism, to accept Christ's blood and to continue on in sin. You don't want to just stay in Egypt. You don't want to continue in sin. You accept the blood of Christ, that Passover sacrifice, and then you proceed to follow Christ out of Egypt. The living Christ, the resurrected Christ. Think about these identifying signs. Sabbath observance, the seven annual festivals, the annual Sabbaths that we observe in God's church. It really and truly does set us apart. It's very different from everything that you see in the world today. And yet, how meaningful, how inspiring, how wonderful is this history and all of the lessons that we can draw from it. Verse 51, it says, and it came to pass the selfsame day that the Eternal did bring the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their armies. He brought Israel out of captivity by this unbelievable series of miracles. They all happened. Scholars and academics, even religionists today, they would say, well, those things didn't actually happen. They did happen. And what a joyous occasion it was. Following that night, that evening, where there was so much death all across Egypt, and then the next night to go out with a high hand, to go out celebrating their release, their miraculous release from captivity. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we finish this study on tomorrow's show, we'll come back to some of the events that happened on their journey out of Egypt, getting into Exodus 13 and 14. So join us for that on tomorrow's program. If you'd like to email the show, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.